What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish is Ruhama Fuhrman, author of The Rebbetzin's Courtyard. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our two Jewish Mevinah on Israel, Oshrat Barel, and our Shinshinim, Chen Dinachi, and Tamir Shakuri. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. We began the Jewish calendar month of Adar this past week, and Adar is the lightest-hearted month of all, since it includes the joyous, silly festival of Purim. We say, Mishenichnas Adar marbim besimcha. When you enter Adar, you multiply joy. And I hope this proves to be true for all of you wonderful two Jewish listeners. This may be midwinter for people in most northern hemisphere climates, but it's definitely the beginning of springtime for us here in the Southwest and in Florida, where baseball spring training is starting up. Pitchers and catchers having reported last week, and the rest of the players coming in this week. Games start this coming Friday, which means it's time to play our classic welcome to the upcoming 2018 baseball season. Mandy Patinkin's Yiddish version of Take Me Out to the Ball Game.
Koyf mir den nislochen Cracker Jack Will ich kein Mulf und dort nicht weg Jetzt ein Mut die Ballspieler Es passt nicht, als man verspielt Weil sie sehen, zwei, drei Steigs Neues bei der Baseballspiel
That was Nehmt mir ois zu dem Ballgame, as sung by Mandy Patinkin in the Yiddish version of Take Me Out to the Ballgame. By the way, the melody for Take Me Out to the Ballgame was written by Albert von Tilzer, a Jewish Tin Pan Alley top songwriter from Indianapolis. He changed his name from Albert Gum to make it sound more aristocratic. When they wrote the song, neither he nor the lyricist had ever been to a baseball game. That remained the case for both of them for decades after their song became popular. But that song certainly has made it to every professional ball game for the last, 80 years or so. It's also rodeo week out here in Tucson, Arizona, in the heart of the Wild West where I live, so we need some Western themes this morning. Can't really understand what a big deal rodeo is here in Tucson unless you live here and have lived here for at least a year or two, or 19 years, like me. In Tucson, our rodeo week consists of a big parade, non-mechanized, followed by, shockingly, a rodeo. We let kids out of school for a couple of days to go to the parade, wear cowboy boots and hats, and generally pretend that we still have some connection to the folks who rode horses and tamed the Wild West. When you live in the heart of the West, not far from Tombstone in what was Apache country not much over a century ago, the rodeo is still a pretty big deal. And that's just fine for us here at Too Jewish, partner. You might not immediately associate Jews and cowboys, but there were quite a number of Jews wandering around the Old West. The legendary O.K. Corral gunslinger and lawman, Wyatt Earp's common-law wife, well, his last one anyway, was a Jewish woman named Josephine Marcus. There were Jewish mayors, sheriffs, outlaws. If you aren't sure of that, go and visit Boot Hill's Jewish cemetery in Tombstone, you know, where the O.K. Corral was. And of course, there were plenty of Jewish merchants, including some of my ancestors, the Reinhardts, who had a store in the gold country near Auburn, California. They sold dungarees there in the middle of the 19th century, especially the newly invented ones with rivets by a German-Jewish entrepreneur named Levi Strauss. I think some of us may still wear that brand. And so, in honor of all those Jewish cowboys, merchants, and characters, here's a less than perfectly accurate musical version of another one of those legendary Jewish characters of the Old West, Long before saddles blazed across the plains, there was the Ballad of Irving.
He was short and fat and rode out of the west with a Mogan David on his silver vest. He was mean and nasty right clear through, which was kind of weird because he was yellow too. They called him Irving. Big Irving. Big short Irving. Big short fat Irving. The 142nd fastest gun in the West. He came from the old bar mitzvah spread with a 10-gallon yarmulke on his head. He always followed his mother's wishes. Even on the range, he used two sets of dishes. Irving. Big fat Irving. Big sissy Irving. The 142nd fastest gun in the West.
Irving.
141 could draw faster than he, but Irving was looking for 143. Walked in the Sol Saloon like a man insane and ordered three fingers of 2 cents plain. Irving. Big fat Irving. Big sport Irving. The 142nd fastest gun in the West.
Irving.
The James boys was coming on a train at first sun, and the town said, Irving, we need your gun. Well, that train pulled in at the break of dawn. Irving's gun was there, but Irving was gone. Irving. Big fat Irving. Big help Irving. The 142nd fastest gun in the West. Finally, Irving got 3 slugs in the belly. It was right outside the Frontier Deli. He was sitting there twirling his gun around, and Butterfingers Irving gunned himself down. Irving. Big fat Irving. Big dum-dum Irving. Big dum-dum dead Irving. The 142nd fastest gun in the West.
Really?
That was the Ballad of Irving, redefining the word classic all by itself about being Jewish in the Wild West. Ruchama Fuhrman is the author of The Rebbetzin's Courtyard, a wonderful follow-up audiobook to her debut novel In the Courtyard of the Kabbalist. We are delighted to have her back on Too Jewish and to find out what happened to her remarkable characters when we return in a moment, right here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome the Too Jewish our guest this morning, Ruchama King Fuhrman is the author of The Rebbetzin's Courtyard, which is a new short story and audio sequel to her wonderful book, In the Courtyard of the Kabbalist. We had her here on Too Jewish a few years ago with that award-winning novel. Tell us a little bit about what led you to follow up in this way.
I think that kind of every novel has some residue. As you're going around and talking about it and getting interviewed about it, hopefully, things start to bounce around in your brain. So just like my first novel, Seven Blessings, it sort of led to my second one because I'd had an Arab character inside there that somehow got edited out of that story. So he came back full-blown into In the Courtyard of the Kabbalist. You know, so too, as I was going around to different parts of the country and talking about it and thinking about it, I kept on, not only did people keep on asking me, well, what happened next, but I was thinking about the characters. They really do live with you for a while, maybe your whole life. And I was thinking about the Rebbetzin and what what happened. So that was just on the simple level.
I wonder also, because in the Rebbitzin's courtyard, she's kind of a shadowy figure. I mean, she's a very sympathetic figure, but the focus is on the protagonist, Isaac, and then the Kabbalist himself. So now this woman takes a very interesting role.
I felt that it was time for her to get her due.
In Kabbalah, in mysticism, the female is by far the most important aspect of the divine. You know, that's the Shekhinah, with which we can interact. And yet, there aren't so many female Kabbalists that we hear about.
I think in my book, in the Courtyard of the Kabbalists, I name a few. I think that was sort of the theme of in the Courtyard of the Kabbalist, how there are women like that, but they don't like to be so prominent for various reasons. And so what was unusual about this story, which I think is also just a self-contained story, you don't have to have read the novel to appreciate it as a self-contained short story, but one of the things about it is that she is now coming out far more publicly. So I do believe that there's a lot of hidden mysticism out there and among the women. And in a way, it's probably healthier that way, in terms of spiritually healthier, because there's less chance for it to get contaminated by ego and power and money and all kinds of things that sometimes we can see. But yes, I think that we're starting to see more now. Things are shifting.
We will talk much more with Ruchama Fuhrman when we return in just a moment here on Too Jewish. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcast, Top 10 in North America, according to Moment magazine. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
The Jewish community in Germany has grown. It's one of the few growing Jewish communities in the world. That's always strange for people thinking about the Holocaust and thinking there were no Jews left in Germany. Tell us a little bit about your... I know you've done some research on it for a trip you're leading not too long from now. Tell us a little bit about the Jewish community in Germany and your perception.
Well, it's a complicated picture, in part because for many years following World War II and following the Holocaust, Germany was divided into two countries. The so-called Federal Republic of Germany, with its capital in Bonn, which was a NATO member and a strong ally of ours, and the German Democratic Republic,
the GDR,
with its capital in Berlin. And, you know, for most of the world, except the United States, both countries were known by their German acronyms. So the West Germany, as we called it, was BRD, Bundesrepublik Deutschland, and East Germany was the DDR, as you just said, which is the Deutsche Demokratische Republik. And for most of the post-war period, until well after the wall came down, Jewish communities in the two halves of the country had very different histories. In what we used to call West Germany, and by the way, there's now one capital, and it's Berlin, and Germany's been reunified now for like 30 years. I think we just hit, or we will hit this year, the 30th anniversary.
Right.
But still, I mean, in many ways, especially in the countryside, they're still separate countries. You can see the communist past and the greater level of poverty and stuff in what was East Germany, and West Germany looks extremely prosperous and like the model Western European democracy. Nonetheless, in both halves of the country, you know, right-wing extremism, neo-Nazism, neo-nationalism, all on the rise, just like many other places in Europe. Perhaps more alarming in Germany because of the recent past. Okay, so back to the Jews. In West Germany, and specifically in West Berlin, lots of Jews who got permission to leave the former Soviet Union left via Berlin. And many of them never moved further than Berlin. They were maybe supposed to go to Israel or Canada or the U.S. or maybe somewhere else in Western Europe, but they stayed in Berlin. So a large very significant percentage of the Jewish community in West Berlin is people from the former Soviet Union, of different ages, but, you know, Russian speakers originally, who make a good living in a prosperous, thriving capital, which became even more prosperous and more thriving once Germany was reunited. Also, people, Jews who lived in West Germany and were either survivors or the children or grandchildren of survivors, got restitution of one sort or another. Maybe not in every case and maybe not always enough, but monthly checks, even children and grandchildren of people who were affected by the Holocaust living in Chicago could go to the German consulate there and collect their monthly checks. It was like Social Security for them. So there's a very significant Jewish population in Berlin. And in Berlin, you can choose exactly the type of synagogue you want. Not only Reform, Conservative, Orthodox, but English-speaking, German-speaking, Russian-speaking, Hebrew-speaking, LGBT-friendly, women egalitarian, women can be the rabbi or the cantor, whatever. There's a whole spectrum.
Quite a vital Jewish life. There's a seminary, by the way, ordaining rabbis there.
I mean,
it's quite a Jewish community.
Right. And we'll talk more about this next week, I think.
Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
Okay.
We welcome our Mivinan, Israel Oshrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Avi.
You know, last week was Valentine's Day, which is a big commercial holiday in America, but didn't used to exist in Israel at all. And then a few years ago, I was in Israel on Valentine's Day, and every restaurant was full, and people had heart-shaped balloons, and there were cards and flowers, and it looked not very different from how it does here. Which raises the question, all of these sort of Western traditions seem to be jumping into Israeli society. New Year's Eve. How does that affect Israel? How does that change things?
Yeah, as I said before, it's a great question. And I think it's one of the benefits or I don't know how you want to call it, by being like a one big village, you know, that, you know, information is open to all and you can pick and choose. You have your own, you know, core holidays, Jewish holidays, and then you can adapt the Druze, you can adapt, you know, whatever you
hear. You can have the Muslim
Chinese
holidays.
What is the, there is a...
Chinese New Year's?
No, they have like something that it's a big sale, but it's like the Chinese Bachelor Day, that it's become like the big sale on, you know.
No,
all
kidding.
Yeah. It's funny. I've never heard it before, but now it's part of my tradition. Why not? You know, so you have your own religion holidays, and then all these secular, you know, even 4th of July has been celebrated in Israel.
Wow.
Betach.
I remember doing a 4th of July barbecue in Israel in the 1990s. Nobody knew what the heck would make
sense. It's another day to do barbecue outside in July. You know, it's beautiful outside in Tel Aviv, so why not?
Hey, in Jerusalem, there's Gan HaPamon. There's Liberty Bell Park there. You know, you could go there for that.
So my answer will be like, I would say that we will add more and more and more until, you know, every day on the calendar will be a holiday. And then we will pick, and then we will go back to prioritize, and we will, you know, go back to the core, and it will be kind of again and again. That's what I think.
You know, it's fascinating.
By the way, in America, you have Boss Day and whatever day, and every day is there is no regular day in America. That's what I found out.
No, but a lot of them are...
According to Hallmark, every day is a day for a card.
Yeah, it's Secretary's Day, Office Assistant's Day, and it's Boss's Day. And it's Donut Day, but nobody thinks about them the way, I think, in Israel, because of the strong Jewish calendar, which is, we have a silly amount of Jewish holidays to start with. It's interesting to see that quality. The other question that raises for me is, in Israel, it used to be you went to the makolet, you bought your food at the little, you know, market on the corner, and then gradually you went to the supersol, there was a bigger market, and then it became, you know, there still are outdoor markets, but it's become much more westernized. Is that just inevitable, or is some of that still going to stay in Israel, that kind of local Middle Eastern Israeli quality?
I can answer with you know, kind of a question I got when I did one of my presentation about Israel, and I showed pictures about, you know, McDonald's in Israel and H&M, and she said, no, I don't want this Israel, I want my old Israel. for H&M and McDonald's, I can find them here. I don't need to come to Israel. And it's a good, you know, I didn't have an answer. What do you want us to stay at the 70s, you right, know, that's what right. you'll say. You want these old...
With the terrible Burger Ranch hamburgers, you know, is that...
So, I don't know. We will wait and see.
You know, change is inevitable. It's part of life. It defines life. But maybe some things we want to keep. I think we'll keep the rest of the Jewish holidays, though. Thanks, Ashrat. We'll talk next week.
Toda rabbi.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie new, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Morris gets a new dog and can't wait to show off how smart he is to his friend Shlomo. He calls the dog into the house, bragging about how wonderful the dog is. Dog runs up, stands looking at his master, tail wagging furiously, mouth open, tongue hanging out, eyes bright with anticipation. Morris points to the newspaper on the couch and commands, "Fetch! Fetch!" Immediately, however, the dog climbs onto the couch and sits down. His tail stops wagging. His head droops. Looking balefully up at his master, the dog says in a whiny voice, "You think it's easy wagging my tail all the time? Oi, Gewalt! It's so sore from the wagging. And that expensive organic dog food you feed me? You taste it. It's dreck. You just don't care about me anymore at all. No love. You shove me out the door to pish 3 times a day, and that's it. I can't remember the last time you took me for a walk." Shlomo is amazed. "Oh, my goodness. Your dog is sitting there, talking out loud and complaining." "I'm sorry," explains Morris. "He's a little hard of hearing. He thought I said kvetch." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Tetzaveh in the book of Exodus, a ritually oriented parsha which gives the commandment to create a ner tamid, an eternal light, for the tabernacle in the wilderness. The tabernacle was the first sanctuary of the people of Israel. Although, technically speaking, the tabernacle, the Mishkan, was a very elaborate, portable tent, it was also the place where God's presence in the form of the Shekhinah resided. In a sense, that's where God lived. Or, more accurately, since God is everywhere, it was where God was most available to us. Last week in Truma, our ancestors were asked to create this sacred space through the voluntary gifts of their hearts. This week we're told that there should be a continual fire, a ner tamid, a constant light shining on the altar, sign of God's faithful and permanent presence in our midst. Revealingly, that light is to be created and kindled by us, not by God. We must build the altar and the fire, and continue to feed and nurture it to keep it alive. If you've ever kept the fire burning around the clock, say at a campout or a bonfire, or for heat on a cold winter's night in some frigid clime, you know just how much fuel you need to do it. You're always either stoking or bringing in more wood for the fire. If neglected for any length of time, it burns out. The Ner Tamid was therefore not just a symbol, but a process requiring regular care and feeding to flourish. Our spiritual life is like that ancient Ner Tamid. If we wish God's presence to illuminate our lives, to give us warmth and comfort, then we, too, must feed our own Ner Tamid, must gently and regularly add spiritual fuel to the flame. Religious experiences, prayer, meditation, introspection, saying blessings, personal and communal rituals, time for breathing and allowing God into our lives— all of these help feed the fire, and they must be done with regularity, or our own internal, eternal light may, even will, go out. The Ner Tamid, that ancient light, is found today in every synagogue in the world, no matter how humble the shul or how grand the temple. While today we simply pay electric bills to keep it alive, even that requires our active participation. But its symbolic purpose is much greater. The Ner Tamid burns always to remind us that God is with us always, if we only take the time to feed our own spiritual fires regularly. When we return on Too Jewish, our guest, Ruchama Fireman, helps feed our own fires of imagination with her new novella, The Rebbetzin's Courtyard. Find out how when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
There were important developments in the corruption investigations into the dealings of Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu last week. Israeli police announced that there was sufficient evidence to prosecute the Prime Minister, indicating he took bribes on two separate cases and acted against public interests. The two cases are the so-called Case 1000, in which Netanyahu is suspected of accepting lavish gifts from wealthy benefactors in return for advancing their interests, and Case 2000, which alleges Netanyahu tried to strike a deal that would provide him with positive coverage in Israel's second-largest newspaper, Yediot Ahronot, in exchange for hurting its free rival, Israel Hayom. According to the police, in Case 1000, Netanyahu received champagne, cigars, jewelry, and clothing by demand and systematically, valued at over $1 million shekels, about $280,000. That's a lot of cigars and champagne, even though it was over an 11-year period. Still, it's $25,000 worth of luxury goods annually. The gifts were received from Israeli-American Hollywood producer Arnon Milchan and increased significantly when Netanyahu was elected prime minister. Police said that in return for the gifts, Netanyahu gave Milchan a bunch of specific benefits. He pushed for the so-called Milchan law, which gives tax breaks to Israelis returning to Israel who have spent time abroad. That break was worth over $1 million shekels alone for Milchan. Yair Lapid, now in the political opposition, but who was once Netanyahu's finance minister, testified against Bibi on this one. Apparently, Netanyahu assisted Milchan in extending his U.S. visa and set up a meeting between Milchan and the then director general of the communications ministry to also advance the producer's interest in the Israeli television market. The prime minister also intervened to prevent the collapse of Israel's Channel 10 television network, in which Milchan was a minority shareholder. And, in addition, Netanyahu helped further a deal tied to Indian businessman Ratan Tata, Milchan's business partner. Police said Netanyahu pushed the deal, even though officials in the defense ministry and the prime minister's office opposed the project. Australian billionaire James Packer was Milchan's partner. Israeli police did not specify what benefits he may have received. The value of the gifts that Milchan gave Netanyahu was 750,000 shekels, about $212,000. Those from Packer amounted to around 250,000 shekels, about 70 grand. Packer began supplying gifts to Netanyahu when he and Milchan decided to divide the burden of Bibi gift-giving between them. In the other case, Case 2000, police say Netanyahu and the publisher of Yediot Ahronot daily newspaper Arnon Moses had a give-and-take relationship, and both acted according to verbal agreements. The police discovered Netanyahu called lawmakers to his house over one weekend to discuss legislation that would benefit Moses. The Israeli police also stressed that the prime minister and Moses held negotiations with the intent of reaching a deal, not as a smokescreen, which is what Netanyahu claimed. There is apparently strong evidence to charge Moses as well as Milchan. The prime minister maintained he did nothing wrong, claimed on numerous occasions there will be nothing because there is nothing. In the days leading up to the police recommendations, Netanyahu openly questioned the integrity of the police commissioner and other high-ranking officers tasked with the investigations. This should feel like deja vu for Americans. In an interview broadcast last week, Police Commissioner Roni Alshech claimed powerful people have been gathering information about the investigators in Netanyahu's cases. Netanyahu responded in a Facebook post calling the claims ludicrous, saying the police chief's comments cast a shadow over the investigation. Netanyahu has continued to criticize the police, including the head of the anti-fraud unit involved. Well, in more positive news from the Holy Land and further evidence that Israel is a free country with a vital and open culture, the Israel Prize, Israel's National Award for Literature, one of its most prestigious honors, is going to be awarded this year to novelist David Grossman, an outspoken critic of Israel's policy towards Palestinians. Grossman, who is 64 years old, has expressed support for Israeli conscientious objectors, the creation of a Palestinian state, and the need to avoid war with Iran over its nuclear program. Announcing the award last week, Education Minister Naftali Bennett, a strong nationalist, described the Jerusalem-born novelist as one of the most exciting, profound, and influential voices in Israeli literature. Grossman won the 2017 Man Booker International Prize for Fiction. He will receive the Israel Prize on Yom HaAtzmaut, Independence Day, in April. Bennett described the decision as a move towards reconciliation in a country with deep divides over matters of war and peace. I disagree with the author David Grossman politically, Naftali Bennett said in public remarks to members of his Jewish home party, but he's not an author of the left wing, and I am not education minister of the right wing. I am education minister for all of the state of Israel. The time has come to heal the rifts, Bennett said. Halavai. Grossman's books have been translated into more than 35 languages. They include A Horse Walks Into a Bar, about a fictional stand-up comedian and the ghosts of his past, and To the End of the Land, a novel depicting a soldier's mother trekking across Israel to avoid hearing possible news of his death. Grossman's own son was killed fighting in the 2006 Lebanon War. In articles for the left-wing Haaretz newspaper, Grossman wrote that Israel's military has cultivated injustice and oppression and the killing of civilians and children in the occupied territories, areas where Palestinians, of course, seek to establish a state. In the year 2015, David Grossman withdrew in protest from consideration for that year's Israel Prize after Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu removed several of the judges, accusing them of being extremist and anti-Zionist. Grossman voiced surprise that he had been chosen. I don't know who was on the committee that picked me. I have no idea, but it was a choice that was to the point, based on artistic and literary criteria, Grossman said. Mazel tov to David Grossman.
Fight fiercely, Harvard! Fight, fight, fight! Impress them with our prowess, do! All fellows, do not let the crimson down. Be of stout heart and true. Come on, chaps, fight for Harvard's glorious name. Won't it be peachy if we win the game? Oh, goody, let's try not to injure them. But fight, 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 let's not be rough, though. Fight, 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 and do fight fiercely. Fight, fight, fight.
And in Brookline, Massachusetts, Lawrence Bacow has been tapped to be the next president of Harvard University. The university made the announcement last week. Bacow, a lawyer and economist, is the former president of Tufts University for a decade. He will replace Drew Gilpin Faust, retiring in June. Bacow had served on the search committee that hired Faust. An expert in environmental policy, Bacow, 66 years old, is originally from Pontiac, Michigan. He received his undergraduate degree from MIT, has a law degree and PhD from Harvard. He was president of Tufts from 2001 to 2011. Prior to leading Tufts, he was chancellor at MIT, where he also spent 24 years on the faculty. Bacow most recently served 3 years at the Harvard Graduate School of Education and is currently a leader in residence at the Harvard Kennedy School. He's been a member of the Harvard Corporation, the university's governing board, since 2011. He also serves on the boards of LiquidNet, Lowe's Corp, Henry Schein, Inc., and TIAA CREF. At Tufts, Bacow oversaw a fundraising campaign that raised $1.2 billion. He's credited with strengthening the university's ties to the surrounding community. Bacow hung a mezuzah on the front of the president's residence at Tufts. He participated in events at the campus Hillel. Bacow is the son of a Holocaust survivor. His mother survived Auschwitz, and his father, born in Minsk, Belarus, was brought to the United States as a child to escape the pogroms of Eastern Europe. I would not be standing here today, literally, if this country had turned its back on my parents, Bacow said during his introductory news conference at Harvard. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Round the World. We are delighted to welcome back the Two Jewish, our guest this morning. Ruchama King-Fuhrman was born in Nashville, Tennessee, grew up in Virginia and Maryland, and at the age of 17 bought a one-way ticket to Israel to seek her fortune, or spiritual fortune in any case. She lived and taught in Israel for a number of years and has written two previous novels. She was here on Two Jewish talking about In the Courtyard of the Kabbalists. Her first novel was called Seven Blessings, and her new short story, not that short, is called The Rebbetzin's Courtyard. I don't know, could we call it a novella, or is that making it too big?
Go ahead, call it a novella. I like the sound of it.
It sounds more mystical anyway, a novella, doesn't it?
Yes.
There are certain interesting perceptions that people have about Kabbalah, about Jewish mysticism publicly, you know, the old tradition. You're not supposed to learn it until you're 40 years old and married with children and a man. Almost none of those things are actually true. Tell us a little bit about how you began to study Kabbalah yourself and why it's become such a focus of your work.
Oh, boy. I'm afraid I haven't studied Kabbalah. I've studied Hasidut, which you could call a popularized version of Kabbalah.
You can indeed.
And I think that whoever says that they've studied Kabbalah most likely hasn't.
That's a great way of saying it. Wait, I have to tell you a story. Danny Matt, who's one of the most prominent translators, he translated the Zohar, he's an incredible scholar, had him out to do a scholar in residence, and he said, you know, I'm not a Kabbalist. I just try to study about it. And I thought, if he cannot be a Kabbalist, I too cannot be a Kabbalist. So,
well put.
Why did this become the focus of your interest?
It didn't, really. To be really frank, I would have called it In the Courtyard of the Rebbe. But I think that there's a nice alliteration with Kabbalist and courtyard. And also there's just, you know, Rebbes, I guess, don't have the same amount of interest as Kabbalists. It's like a hot topic.
That's right.
And the publishers definitely wanted that. And I'd say one of the interesting things about Isaac is that in the novel and also in this short story is that he very much resists Kabbalah or the more woo-woo and mystical aspects of Judaism. He's a rationalist and he doesn't care for it. And so it's not only so much that he objects to the Rebbetzin achieving this sort of spiritual, mystical stature, but he doesn't like it in general. Rabbi Yehuda, he never was that way. And the truth is there's all kinds of Kabbalists. There are those who just study it. And also, when you say a Kabbalist, it has to be somebody who embodies it and not just studies it. Your friend is right. And there are people who, Kabbalists who dabble in all kinds of little cute tricks like reading your palm or your forehead or tinfoil, who knows what. And then there are those who just are really just wise counselors and people who are connected to a higher, more supernal wisdom, more than your average rabbi or Rebbetzin.
People that are trying to look into your soul, they're sometimes described as doing.
Yes.
In the book, in the initial novel, The Courtyard of the Kabbalist, which should be called In the Courtyard of the Rebbe, Shendel somehow, she emerges even in that book as having a great deal of wisdom. Tell how you changed her in putting together this story.
She changed, right. She's a different person. Well, I have to tell you how this came about. Actually, you asked on the simple level how it is that I wrote this sequel. But there was something else that was sort of bouncing around in my brain. I know that I had read a piece in the magazine Jerusalem Report. I don't know if it's still in existence.
No, it's a great, great magazine, actually.
Good. So I remember there was a little interview of somebody who had visited a Kabbalist courtyard. And I thought it was, the man was very, very much the antithesis of the down-to-earth practical Reb Yehuda. And he is, what happens is that everyone comes to him and tells him their problems. And then come late afternoon, he spews forth all the various answers. And you see people, it's like quite hilarious, people have tape recorders and microphones, and they keep on trying to grasp the words that are coming out of this Kabbalist's mouth. And I think that, to me, like, the real story was what's going to happen when the Kabbalist leaves and people try to figure out whose answer belongs to who. And I think what was really gripping me is the whole idea that we have like very much of a consumer attitude, not only towards goods, buying your bread, buying your whatever, but also towards spirituality. Like, you go to the rabbi for your spiritual fix or to synagogue, and then you go home and you lead your life. But what I liked about this, what I was trying to get at here, less so about Shendel Bracha, but about kind of spirituality, is that the real deal is when people are forced to interact with each other. You just don't go home and forget about it, but I imagined that everyone would be locked in the courtyard and they would all have to hear each other's story and somehow piece together whose answer belongs to who. And only in this way, when everybody comes together, you know, all the various odd characters, the Arab lawyer who hears ghosts, the woman with carpal tunnel, the husband who compulsively tells the truth, all the odd characters have to somehow listen and hear each other's story. And only then can there really be shlemut or wholeness? So I'm just was trying to offer a different kind of concept of spirituality beyond what we have in our consumer times.
A sense of community, in this case, almost an enforced community.
Yes, but it's sort of like it's an enforced community where people are pushed to really see other people, to see the other. And that's something that I guess people don't want to do unless they're really prodded. That's always has been a theme of my books, especially in The Courtyard of the Cabalist. You know, seeing the other, seeing the invisible people, the schleppers, the beggars, the people who are, you know, deformed, or you know, people that you just want your eyes to glaze over.
You know, it's the famous story about where do you find Elijah the prophet? He's outside the walls of the city, sitting with the beggars and the lepers.
It's a beautiful story. The one Agnon wrote about that.
Correct. Yeah, taken from an old midrash, actually.
Yes.
Of course, everything Agnon writes sounds like a midrash anyway. So,
so true.
In a way, almost all the characters, I don't know, in your books are kind of like that, aren't they?
Kind of like, you mean like
outsiders, the guy who's never quite made it, but maybe he's studying to be a rabbi, but he doesn't quite finish. The woman who's definitely coming from somewhere else in a different culture, who's now in this situation, the, as you said, the schleppers.
Well, you know, don't you think we all have an inner schlepper? Aren't we all outsiders? I can't tell you, like, I sometimes in my community, I'll see a woman who seems to be the most together, the one who's got a finger in all the pies, the big macher, and, you know, you get to talk to her, she feels like an outsider. She feels marginal. You know, it just seems to be when you get to know people, you know, everyone has a shtickle schlepper inside them.
That's beautiful. And it's something, in a way, that you sort of celebrate in your books. People find healing, they find wholeness, shlemut, as you said, sometimes, not by suppressing that, but by experiencing it more fully.
By experiencing, you mean their schleppiness?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's, you know what it is? When I was trying to get to know Isaac, and it was hard. It was hard to enter him at times. And so my husband, who's a psychologist, he said, ask yourself, what is it that Isaac does not want to know about himself? And I found that very useful. There's so many things that all of us do not want to know about ourselves. And somehow when we're brought into contact with that aspect, it can bring a lot of shlemut. So, yeah.
So it's getting into contact, getting into conversation, if you will, with that which we don't want to face.
Right, and don't want to know about ourselves.
Is that what makes for good writing?
I would say I try to apply the same thing to most of my characters now. That one bit of advice he gave me really, really does help me. Because, you know, to be honest, I can't write the way that other writers write, in the sense that I don't like to write lewdly or, you know, sexual situations, curse words. And so that's very limiting. So what I have to do is I have to really dig deep in the character area. That's where I have to, that's my chance to get more mileage. And so it helps me. It certainly helps me. I think it could help other writers too.
Tell us a little bit about writing and having something in an audiobook format. And how that feels.
It's the same narrator as in The Courtyard of the Cabalist. It's Sam Gunsler.
Sam Gunsler, right.
And I was lucky enough in that the publisher allowed me to try out a few different actors. And I thought they were all pretty amazing, given that most of them were coming from extremely different backgrounds. But as soon as I heard, but they were not quite right. I kept on asking for more. And then when I heard Sam Gunsler, and it wasn't just the Yiddish way he pronounced Fleishiks and Milchiks, so let me know he's from the hood. But but it was, you know, he really got into the kishkas of the characters. And I remembered then that, oh my, this is even before I remembered, I had seen Sam Gunsler perform in this wonderful book, this wonderful play called The Quarrel.
The Quarrel is a fantastic story. It's a great play. It's also, they made an excellent movie about it.
Yeah, so I think I'm not sure if he was in the movie or the play. I think he was in maybe both. Mm-hmm. But it's based on Chaim Grada's short story, yeah. My Quarrel with Herschel Rosanna.
Yeah, yeah, the secular Yiddish poet and the ultra-Orthodox guy who meet, who are the chaverim, they were the study partners in Yeshiva?
He was the same character. He was the same actor. And I thought he was phenomenal. He also happens to have been in places like The Soprano and The Good Wife and other places like that. And he really... the funny thing is that I never listened to it. I never listened to the rendition, but people told me it was fantastic. And just this morning, I was just at a friend's house, and out of the blue, she just said, she has this machine called Echo. Maybe you know about it.
Yeah, yeah.
You talk to it, and it...
It's everywhere
said,
now.
Okay. So she said, Echo, play Rahama Feuerman's audio of this. And I first said, no, I don't want to hear it. I don't know why. I thought it would make me queasy. And then when I heard it, I was just under a spell. It was such an odd and wonderful feeling. He really did such a fantastic job, and he gets into all the voices, and I could lose myself into it and forget that I had written it. So it was it was so transformative for me. I loved it.
I want to thank Ruchama Foreman for a great visit again here on Too Jewish. Where can people go to get the audiobook?
You just go on Amazon, or you can go to Blackstone Audio Publishers, but Amazon is probably the... It's very inexpensive. It's like $4 or something, and takes 48 minutes. And I think that's the way to go.
And if you already have, you know, an Audible subscription, you get it either way.
Free for if you have an Audible subscription.
That's right.
And otherwise, you could just pay the $4.
Which is well worth it. Ruchama, thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure being here. And you ask great questions.
My pleasure. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guests and get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the Soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Too Jewish will be Elchanan Miller, an Arab affairs journalist, rabbinical student, and creator of the remarkable new People of the Book YouTube series, discussing perceptions of Judaism in the Muslim world and Arab-Jewish relations today. And, of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or at our TooJewishRadio.com website. Our playout this morning is Adon Olam, the concluding hymn for Shabbat services, sung by three tenors to Uzi Chitman's melody. By the way, Chitman composed 650 songs, including the Israeli standard Nolatati L'Shalom. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Adon Olam, Asher Malach, Beterem Kol, Yetzir Nivra, Le'et Na'asa, Bechefzo Kol, Azai Melech, Azai Melech, Shemo Nikra. Karei tichlot hakol levado imloch nora ve'u haya ve'u ve ve'u ye ve'u ye betifara Adon Olam asher malach beterem kol yetzir וחפצו כל הזי מלך שמו נקרא ואחרי ככלות הכל לבדו ימלוך נורא והוא היה והוא עובה והוא יהיה ותפארה אדון עולם אשר מלך בטרם כל יציר נברא לעת נסע וחפצו כל הזי מלך שמו נקרא ואחרי ככלות הכל לבדו ימלוך נורא והוא היה והוא עובה ותפארה והוא עובה והוא יהיה ותפארה Azay melech, azay melech, shemo nikra.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.